Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum today. As many of you may know, the Institute sponsors the Independent Policy Forum on a regular basis, which is a series of lectures, seminars, debates, and panel discussions on important social and economic issues. And we hold these events here in Washington and also at our conference center in Oakland, California. Our program today is especially timely with the inauguration of Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States. Our event is entitled Assessing the Bush Presidency and the Obama Promises. And we're delighted to have with us here three excellent speakers: Dr. Ivan Eland, Senior Fellow at the Independent Institute and author of the new book which we're featuring tonight called Recarving Rushmore, Ranking the Presidents on Peace, Prosperity, and Liberty. In addition, we're very pleased to have Congressman Ron Paul, former candidate for the United States Office of President. He's just started his 11th term as U.S. Congressman. And the historian Richard Shankman, who's editor of the History News Network and the author of many books. To provide some background, the Independent Institute is a nonprofit scholarly public policy research institute. We sponsor many in-depth studies of social and economic issues, and we publish the result as books, as well as our journal, The Independent Review, and this is the current issue. And for those of you who are with us here, there are complimentary copies downstairs, and you're welcome to take one. We'd also invite you and our viewers at C-SPAN to visit us at our website, which is independent.org. You'll find information about our publications, conferences, media, and other projects. You'll also find information about our blog, which is called The Beacon, which I think you'll find quite intriguing, as well as our newsletter, our email newsletter at The Lighthouse, and you can sign up for a free subscription on the web, on the homepage of our website. America's first president, George Washington, noted that, quote, government is not reason, it is not eloquence, it is force. Like fire, a troublesome servant and a fearful master, never for a moment should it be left to irresponsible action, unquote. As you know, the subject of our event today is the use of power by American presidents. The U.S. presidency is by far the most powerful position in the world. Indeed, the U.S. government is almost entirely the presidency. The budgets of the Congress and the Supreme Court are virtually inconsequential compared to that of the executive branch. The presidency, after all, includes all of the departments of the federal government, including Treasury, Commerce, and Defense, the IRS, CIA, NSA, NASA, and the FBI, all of the U.S.'s nuclear and other weapons, spy satellites, aircraft carriers, ICBM missiles, hundreds of military bases worldwide, and huge tracts of federal lands, minerals, highways, and waterways. All of the regulatory agencies, the FTC, the FDA, the SEC, OSHA, EPA, and the list just goes on. But to be put so pervasive and so powerful, the presidency is far, far more. For most Americans, the presidency has become a sort of sovereign king and father figure who stands above and beyond mere citizens in order to oversee our lives and our well-being. As such, the presidency is really sort of a secular religious figure, sort of an earthly messiah, who many believe will save them from all forms of harm by wielding government power against others. As a result, around the presidency has grown a cult of power and personality, not unlike in many respects what we find in the history of rulers of the past. The spectacle and circus of the presidential inauguration is really only the beginning of what we all witness day in and day out in the media and popular culture of the cultural trappings of presidential glorification and worship. But what exactly is it they're worshiping? Stripped of the superficial pomp and vanity of some, what do you really have? Doesn't each president, after all, take an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution and its limits on executive power? So how did George W. Bush and his predecessors stack up in holding this pledge? Have they increased or decreased peace, prosperity, and liberty, as Dr. Eland's book subtitle is considering? And have they upheld the Constitution in the process? Was Lord Acton correct in counseling and the founders correct in being mindful of? Power corrupts and absolute power corrupt tends to corrupt absolutely. Ivan Eland is senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. Dr. Eland received his master's degree in applied economics and his PhD in public policy from George Washington University. He earlier spent 15 years working for Congress on budget and national security issues, including the House Foreign Affairs Committee, the Congressional Budget Office, and the Government Accountability Office. And he has testified before many committees in the House and Senate. His articles have appeared in major newspapers and magazines across the country, and he's the author of many books, including the one that we're featuring today, Recovering Rushmore. I'm very delighted to introduce Ivan Eland.
Thanks for coming tonight. I appreciate the nice crowd here. I have a hunch some of you are coming to see congressmen here, but that's okay. I'll get a few sentences in before that. Now, the reason I wrote this book, Recarving Rushmore, was because I felt that the way historians, political scientists, journalists, and even the public evaluated presidential success was off kilter. I didn't go around musty archives trying to unearth startling new historical information about this president or that president. What I did was I took existing sources and I just tried to think about it in a different way, reanalyze it from a different perspective. Now, although the book is about the presidents, it is really an alternative history of the United States. So I thought tonight, you know, we all in Washington, we go to lectures and we hear the speaker speak and then we all get up and ask questions. I thought it'd be interesting if I asked the audience some questions first, kind of reversing the role here. So I'm going to give you a little quiz. I'm going to take a baseline first, then I'll get into the presidents. I have some questions first. The first one is, what happened on July 4th, 1776? Does anybody want to hazard a guess? I don't hear any. Oh, guess you didn't learn that in school, huh? Anybody have a guess? Okay. Okay, question number two. Who did the first powered, controlled flight? Anybody got any ideas? Okay. And who was the first person to fly across the Atlantic? Okay. Now, when I was in college, I volunteered for psychological experiments, and when you go in, they basically trick you because you think you're doing one thing and you're really doing another thing. That wasn't the baseline; that was the quiz, and you all flunked because those answers unbelievably are wrong. The Declaration of Independence was not signed on July 4th. The vote for independence was on July 2nd. Nothing major really happened on July 4th, and John Adams said that he wrote that July 2nd would always be our Independence Day. Well, he was wrong. Okay, now I'm going to go through these quick because I really do want to get on to the presidents, but I have a point in doing this. Okay, the second one, what was my second question? Oh, yeah, the Wright brothers. The Wright brothers were not the first people to fly under controlled powered flight. There was a guy named Gustav Whitehead who did it 2 years before, and while the Wright brothers were getting a few hundred yards, 832 yards, I think, or 800 and some yards in their plane, he took a flight 7 miles, and he did it 2 years before the Wright brothers, and the reason that he didn't get the fame, there were two reasons. The first one, nobody took a photograph. The famous photograph got in all the school kids' history books. And the Smithsonian for years refused, they wanted the Wright brothers' plane because it became so famous, but they refused to put the fathers of flight because they knew it wasn't really true until the family said, well, you're not getting the plane unless you put that on there. So they did. And the second reason he didn't get any credit was because he was a German immigrant, and if you recall, we were leading up to World War I at the time, and German immigrants were not too fondly regarded at the time. Okay, the third one, Charles Lindbergh, he was probably the 82nd person to fly across the Atlantic. Now, I'm not kidding, but it's hard to say because there were various crews and various aircraft that did it, but he was not the first. Many more people did it. The reason he became famous is because people in Paris listened to all the tribulations that he had on his trip, and so they all rushed out to the field, and he was really shocked when he landed at all these people. He had made such an issue that he landed, and they picked him up and carried him around. And of course, he became famous. But of course, now the reason I mention these three events is not because they have anything to do with presidents. It's because what you think you read in your history books in high school and college may not be true. And then some of the stuff that is true, they've left out some things. So I just want you to think about that while I go into this, because my ratings of presidents are much different than the ratings of conservatives and liberals, which, although there are some differences, they seem to be coalescing around some agreement, actually, on those, even on presidents like Reagan. But it's not really because that I think they're right. Everyone thought the world was flat until they figured out it wasn't. Some guy did it, and he's figured out it wasn't, right? So groupthink is not necessarily correct. And I believe that both parties now, and both the left and the right in the United States, have the bias of they like activist big government, both at home and abroad, with noted exceptions sitting to my left. So I wrote this book saying, well, let's just look at the policies. Let's not look at charisma, which many historians, they wouldn't consciously say they fall victim to charisma, but they take it into account, I think. Otherwise, why would Teddy Roosevelt get so much play? William McKinley, his predecessor, was a much more important president than Teddy Roosevelt. They also love activism, an active president who's bold and that sort of thing. But is that always the way to the right policy? David was just talking about how the presidency has gone into an imperial mode, and maybe now with Bush even into a hyper-imperial mode. Is this the way we want to go? What about the way the founders envisioned the system was that the Congress would be the primary first among equals in the government. Article 1 is not the executive branch, it's the congressional branch. The Constitution specifies in great deal what the Congress's powers were. In Article 2, it's very vague. And of course, unfortunately, the presidents have filled that void with many actions that were probably unconstitutional. So now, I try to get rid of the charisma bias. I try to get rid of the activism bias. We like presidents who can give a great speech. We have all heard speeches by Roosevelt and Kennedy, who I don't think were that good of presidents. Maybe we can go into that later. But we love presidents who can turn a good phrase, or at least their speechwriters like Theo Sorensen can turn a good phrase, and the president can deliver the speech in a good way. And lastly, historians are biased because they love presidents who serve in a war or during a crisis. Even if the president contributed to the crisis, didn't prevent the crisis, made it worse, or caused the crisis in the first place. And we have many instances of that in American history, I think. Now, my problem with some of the other analysis is that they assume the posture of the neutral observer. And none of this is neutral, because everyone looks back on history with their current policy views. I'm no different, but I'll tell you what my policy views are. You have to dig around to figure out what the other policy views of other people are. Not everyone, but an example of this is they use the effectiveness criterion. Now, I term it presidential success, not effectiveness, because I want to focus on not whether the president was able to implement his agenda and how effectively he was doing that. Because if you take that to the extreme, if Lenin, Stalin, and Mao were presidents of the United States, they would have been very effective. They should be 1, 2, and 3, right? They did what they wanted to do. So, of course, policy does matter. Policy, what they do, does matter. And I say that's what we ought to concentrate on. It doesn't matter that Bush is not a good orator or he can't put a sentence together. Probably doesn't matter. The policy is what matters, and that's what we need to concentrate on. And I think we haven't really done that very well, and I try to do that. So I noted all these biases, and so I basically, how did I evaluate the presidents? I evaluated them on the basis of whether they upheld the Constitution, meaning a limited role for the presidency. I also evaluated them on whether their policies promoted peace, prosperity, and liberty. And I think we can all agree on those goals, but how do we get there, right? Well, in my view, a limited, read small, government with a restrained executive and a Congress that was first among equals compared to the other two branches is the ideal. That's a republic. And we saw what happened to Rome as power went from the assembly to the Senate, to the dictator, to the emperor. And I'm afraid we're on the slow road to that. And it's sort of like the frog who jumps in the bathtub because it's not cold, and they gradually put up the temperature of the water so that he doesn't know it, and eventually he's dead. And unfortunately, we don't have the dictators that just come in and take power. Over time, through U.S. history, the president has accrued more and more power. Now, the Congress, the founders initially wanted the system to be that the Congress dominated and the states dominated. Well, now we have a system where the president and the Supreme Court dominate, with the president the strongest of those two players. So I say that we don't really have the government that we all celebrate on Independence Day, even though it's the Declaration of Independence that we're supposedly celebrating, which wasn't even signed on that day. But we have this idealized vision of what we're celebrating, and it really isn't, it doesn't correspond with the modern day government. Now you say, well, we have a government, you can change the Constitution. Well, I have no problem if people amend the Constitution, even if I don't agree with the amendment. But they've made the Constitution so hard to amend that people have just amended it without amending it, and that means that it's a living constitution. And I have a problem with that because that undermines the rule of law. So basically, I evaluated each president, whether on the margins they took us away or toward the founders' original vision of small government, which I believe is the best route. And on the road to a small government, a constrained chief executive and restrained foreign policy, which the founders also advocated, which of course both parties have moved way away from. So a president who served in time of big government, who tried to reduce it, like Jimmy Carter and Dwight Eisenhower, get a better rating than presidents who served in a time of small government and increased it, Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe. Now, a word on political party affiliation. Evaluating according to my criteria, the Democrats seem to have the best presidents, but also the worst presidents, and the Republicans seem to have somewhere in the middle, and that probably goes for modern presidents, because party is a very bad indicator. If you look at the, and I think this is a good statistic to use, government as a percentage of GDP, you'll find some astounding things. You'll find that Reagan wasn't a small government person. He doubled the size of the federal government, and LBJ, Nixon, Reagan, and the current president are the biggest spenders if you use the change in GDP, change in federal spending as a portion of GDP, which is astounding. And the two presidents that reduced it the most were Clinton and Carter. Eisenhower came in third. He basically held percentage roughly constant. So that's just one indicator of how things are kind of topsy-turvy. Of course, also, the parties have changed position over time. Until Woodrow Wilson, Democrats were for small government and Republicans were for big government. Then, after Woodrow Wilson, the Democrats joined the Republicans in the big government camp. Present company accepted. He was never in the big government camp. Pre-McKinley, both parties advocated a restrained foreign policy. That was a traditional foreign policy of the United States, meaning limit your interventions militarily overseas. Now, of course, both parties are interventionists abroad. They have different versions of it, but they're still in agreement on it. And the third thing about parties is that sometimes it's easier to go against your party to achieve big success. Nixon went to China. Clinton did welfare reform and free trade. And John Tyler, who incidentally is a very obscure president, but I think was the best president in U.S. history, was almost impeached by his own party sticking up for small government because he was a Whig, and Whigs were for big government. They were the precursor to the Republican Party. And he almost got impeached by his own party. So I think most analysts, both liberal and conservative, are evaluating presidents with a hidden bias toward big government at home and abroad and a powerful chief executive. And to show you how presidents' reputations will change over time, Woodrow Wilson, after World War I, was roundly reviled for having gotten us into that war because there was a lot of carnage. People weren't used to deaths on that scale. And Woodrow Wilson had said we were going to into World War I because of all these idealistic reasons. And it turns out that secret agreement, when the Bolsheviks took power in Russia, they published all these secret treaties, which indicated that our allies, Britain and France, were really making deals so they could expand their empires. So back then, he was reviled. Well, of course, now he's fairly well regarded because everyone has adopted the Wilsonian foreign policy of intervention, and so he has been rehabilitated. This is an example of how we view history through the present day. So I ranked Wilson the 40th of 40 presidents because basically he ruined the entire 20th century, and he's currently working on ruining this one. And he's been long dead. And the reason he did that, of course, was because many of the things he did helped bring Hitler to power. He didn't directly bring Hitler to power, but of course he let the Allies run all over Germany, and he also demanded the abdication of the Kaiser, and of course that opened the way toward Hitler's power, getting to power. And of course, so also he offered aid to the provisional government in Russia and tried to keep it in World War I. Well, of course, World War I was even more unpopular in Russia since they had mass casualties. And so, of course, the Bolsheviks were the only anti-war party. They came to power, and of course, the rest is history there. Now, similarly, Harry Truman ended his presidency with Bush-like popularity numbers, which isn't good. And he didn't run for another term because the Korean War was so unpopular. But Truman does give Bush hope, because his interventionist template for fighting the Cold War was adopted by every post-war World War II president until the East Bloc and the USSR collapsed. So, of course, Truman has been rehabilitated, and bookending the Cold War was Reagan, the last president to serve any length of time before the Berlin Wall fell, and he has become an icon because that happened. We have, we could have had an alternative policy in the Cold War, and that is to let the Soviet Union have South Korea, Vietnam, Angola, Afghanistan, and these other countries with no GDP, let them administer them, let them take the expenses for aid, et cetera. So there are alternative policies that could be followed. And I go into that in the book with various things, especially Lincoln. I think we could have avoided, we could have freed the slaves by avoiding a war that killed 600,000 Americans, and it's still the worst war we've ever had. So you don't have to be a closet Southern sympathizer to criticize Lincoln for that, I think, because the policy, alternative policies can be found. So this brings me to Bush, and then I'll quit here. Bush is hoping for a Truman-like resurrection from the ash heap of bad presidents. I think it's possible that he could actually be, but probably less likely than in Truman's case, because although Truman had the communists, which eventually fell because of their own dysfunctional system, to bring him back, Bush, even if Osama bin Laden is caught or captured or killed, somebody will just say, well, gee, Bush spent 7 years trying to get this guy, and the next guy got him, or maybe the next guy, who knows. But I also think Bush will be blamed for the economic meltdown. They'll probably fail to realize that Bush was less conservative than Clinton in many areas, such as trade and fiscal matters. And I already mentioned Bush profligate spending, and I'm not sure how that will turn out. But Bush's presidency, he likes to compare himself to Ronald Reagan, but I would say his presidency most closely parallels LBJ's, guns and butter. Of course, the butter, the flavor of the butter is a little different, but the butter is still there. Now, there's no way the historians will put lipstick on a pig and have different evaluation of the Hurricane Katrina response. I think, you know, there's no way he can rehabilitate himself from that one. And I think somebody's going to ask why it did take so long to get Osama bin Laden, and did we go off on other tangents, nation building in Iraq and Afghanistan while Osama bin Laden was in Pakistan. Of course, Bush can claim that there were no further major attacks on the U.S. soil after 9/11, but of course, terrorist attacks on U.S. soil have traditionally been rare. Anyway, we've been a haven against terrorism here because of the distances involved. And of course, so the astute historian would ask, well, how many attacks did we have before this, before 9/11? The other thing is, what about 9/11? Bush has been criticized for ignoring warning signs leading up to the attack. So I'm not sure he's going to come out very well on that. And he was sort of baited by Osama bin Laden to overreact, as most guerrillas and terrorists try to get the formidable power to do. And, of course, he went into two Muslim lands, and that's, of course, what drives Islamists crazy, is non-Muslim forces on Muslim land. So, of course, Osama bin Laden, Bush did exactly what he wanted to. Also, even if Iraq becomes a democracy, back in the Spanish-American War days, the Philippines eventually became a democracy, but I don't think historians have changed their opinion that the Spanish-American war was an embarrassing colonial conflict, which resulted in the deaths of 200,000 Filipinos, which you don't hear very much in your, which, excuse me, probably wasn't in your high school or college textbook either. But to me, it's doubtful whether democracy will hold in Iraq. I think there probably will be a conflict when the U.S. leaves, so I don't think that's over with yet. And, of course, Afghanistan is probably a tougher nut to crack than Iraq. Now, Bush's worst transgression is his usurpation of presidential power, turning the imperial presidency into the hyper-imperial presidency. His transgressions include eliminating habeas corpus, illegal and unconstitutional warrantless wiretapping, torture, and kangaroo military tribunals. But alas, if you arch liberals in the audience, if there are any here, I did not rate Bush the worst president ever. And the reason that I didn't was because there are other presidents who've started wars for even more questionable reasons, or presidents who started wars and had much greater implications. Now, why do I focus on the wars? My book says peace, prosperity, and liberty. I think peace is the most important one of those, and I think conservatives should listen up here, because a lot of conservatives are really neoconservatives, and they don't know it, because ever since William F. Buckley in the 50s, conservatism has been defined, at least the mainstream conservatism, present company again excepted, on the basis of, well, we in the 50s, it was, we fight the Soviet Union, and if we're going to get some big government, so we better take that too, but we'll try to reduce it as much as we can, but the central thrust is to fight the communists. Well, of course, we still have this bias, I think, and so of course Bush is neoconservative is the extreme portion of this, but Bush is. I think in his own mind, he probably had some legitimate reasons for invading Iraq. I'm not sure they were correct. James Polk, on the other hand, invaded Mexico, grabbed half its land, and then, of course, lied about it to Congress. So if that's similar, yes, it is. But I think Polk's is probably a worse transgression because he was just out after the territory. There was no dressing it up. William McKinley, I rated below him because he started the Spanish-American War, which, of course, had tremendous implications for our foreign policy. It was our first colonial war, and it started us on the road to what I call an informal empire. And also, McKinley was the first modern president. Whenever we say modern, we mean excess power in excess of the Constitution. Of course, there were other presidents before that did that, but McKinley was the first president of the 20th century, and he certainly consolidated power as a result of the Spanish-American War. He was a much more important president than Teddy Roosevelt, who was much more charismatic. I rated Truman next to the last because he chose to fight an interventionist Cold War, and I think he could have done it in a more Republican fashion. His policies led to the first permanent standing army in the history of the United States. The founders were tremendously against that, and it endured for a long time, and it was only in the 50s that that happened, which is amazing. But he was responsible for that, and of course, he was also responsible for the imperial presidency, creating the institutions of the imperial presidency. And of course, Wilson, I've already gone into Wilson. He's my last president, and I already explained that. So I've only done the worst ones because those are the most interesting. In the question and answer, we might be able to get to the best ones.
Thank you, Ivan. His book is full of surprises, and it is one that's been heavily recommended by historians and other scholars, and so I hope that each of you will take a look at it. I think you'll find it quite rewarding. I'm especially delighted to introduce our next speaker. Ron Paul is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, as you all know, a two-time presidential candidate. He's clearly the leading spokesman in Washington for limited government, low taxes, free markets, a non-interventionist foreign policy, and a return to sound monetary policies based on a commodity-backed currency. He graduated from Gettysburg College and Duke University School of Medicine before serving as a flight surgeon in the U.S. Air Force during the 1960s, and then as a specialist in obstetrics gynecology in private medical practice. Congressman Paul has been a member of the House Financial Service Committee, the International Relations Committee, and the Joint Economic Committee. He's the author of numerous books, including most recently the number one best-selling book, Revolution and Manifesto. Congressman Paul is renowned for his principled voting record and his critique of the abuse of presidential power.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be here. David, thank you for the invitation. And Ivan, congratulations on your book. It's wonderful. But it is nice to be here to visit about a subject that is very, very important. But I want to assure you that you should rest comfortably because yesterday we all at the Congress took our oath of office and everybody did it very seriously and they held up their right hand and they swore to uphold the Constitution. So I guess we're all okay. But the amazing thing is they were all very serious. And the other amazing thing is they actually believe they do. It's just their interpretation versus our interpretation, and sometimes they're different. But when I was running last year for the presidency, my staff told me we had a couple problems to deal with. More than a couple, but the one was that the record for those individuals who came from Texas and became president, they weren't all that great, and they said they're not ready for another Texan to be president. When you think about two Bushes and then LBJ, I mean, they weren't exactly the greatest presidents in the world. But the other thing is I had this habit of telling people I really didn't want to be president. I mean, I have no desire to under today's conditions. And that the only reason I want to be president, if I'm to be the president, is that it's because of the things I don't want to do. I don't want to run your life. I don't want to run the economy. And I don't want to run the world. And they said, well, no, you have to be sort of more positive about this. And I said, okay, how about peace and freedom and prosperity? Those are pretty good. Those are positive things that we should be running on. But Ivan mentioned the things about sometimes we are deceived into believing some things and they're not really really true. And that is so often the case. But I think a lot of people in Congress and presidents, everybody up and down, deceive themselves. I think that so often is the problem. Right now, I think when members of Congress and even a president takes the oath of office about defending this country and the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, very few of them think are any enemies domestic. All the enemies are those foreigners, you know, whether it's the foreigners who are always attacking us and we have to be prepared and have to have this military machine. Also, it's the foreigners who want to come here. You know, they're always our enemies that we have to deal with. It's hardly those individuals that are undermining our liberties over here on the Hill. But I can tell you in the last year or two, out visiting a lot of people, and by far and large, the people who came to the rallies were young people. When I would emphasize this foreign and I would pause and I said domestic, and it got some pretty loud applauses. So I think there are people starting to wake up and realizing the difference. You know, I do believe this is a true story about Harry Truman. He can hardly be one of our favorite presidents, but I believe it was true that when he left here, you know, he walked down to the railroad station and got on a train and went home. Now, that's great symbolism. I wished it were that simple again. But what is the symbolism that we have today of the presidency? Is it bad as it was then? Is it bad as it's been throughout the 20th century, basically? The symbolism is that Obama now has his Air Force One. He's not even sworn in. He's flying around the country and wherever he wants to go. And it's the Air Force One substitute, but it's essentially the same plane. So this shows how far we have come to sort of bowing to the presidency. I guess the most astounding thing about how much power we have given the president is the willingness of Congress, the many Congresses we've had in the last 100 years or so, their willingness not only to just step back and let the president do whatever he wants, but so often they pass legislation and they give him the authority. I mean, they pass it on and give the president the authority to do what he wants. The resolution to go to war against Iraq was literally amending the Constitution. It didn't tell the president to go to war. It didn't tell the president not to go to war. It told the president whatever he wants to do, he can do that. And some of them said, well, this is pretty good because if he gets into trouble, then it won't be our fault. You know, they don't want to assume the responsibility for it. On trade agreements, the Congress is in charge of trade agreements. And if you can either do it directly and passing laws and do tariffs, or you could have treaties, and you could have the Senate approve treaties. But it's not done that way. We have fast track legislation. We just give the power to the president to negotiate all these deals, and the Congress never says a word. They just give it up. So the Congress yields so much power to the president, both by just omission and letting the president get away with it, but frequently it's through commission. They actually legislate. Now, that should mean maybe what we ought to do then is just don't pay Congress any money and send them all home. You know, one time I made a suggestion. Of course, being in Congress, they thought this was self-serving. I thought we'd be better off if we just paid everybody on the Hill about $1 million if they promised they'd never come to Washington. But that's not so true anymore because this place is on autopilot. You know, it's just going no matter what. I mean, the presidents will do whatever they want, and the courts will do whatever they want. These small little banks called the Federal Reserve System, they do whatever they want. They create all the money that they want. They create trillions of dollars, and they don't have any responsibility to tell anybody what they're doing. So that could be a little bit funny, but it's not funny because the government is just going on and on. But what does Congress do if they're giving the power, all this power to the president? What do they spend their time on? Well, they're doing all the things they shouldn't be doing. They fail to do the things that they should. Instead, they get to give that power to the president. The president does what he wants. And then the things that Congress comes up with, they're passing out more funds. Used to be they'd collect money, you know, and then borrow a little bit. And then they'd have this political football game over there. And who got the most money for their district? And that's how they would get reelected. But it doesn't even require that anymore. I mean, how much of this money that has been committed here in the last 6 months has come through a legal process? And it is almost hardly any. You know, the $700 billion, that's just peanuts, compared to the $8 trillion. We've committed $8 trillion. Well, where does this authority come? Is this presidential authority? Well, indirectly. But that's another branch of government, which is the Federal Reserve. And they do all this funding, and government never slows up. But the president has had way too much power, and it looks like it's going to continue. But why does the Congress do this? Well, I think it's a reflection of the educational system. I think the education in the last 100 years has just been disastrous, and they believe it as a principle that this is a patriotic thing. This is, you know, a constitutional thing to do because it's proper. And besides, the Constitution is not rigid. It's flexible, and it has to adapt to, you know, modern times. So let me tell you, they don't lose any sleep over that. I mean, and they really feel like they're doing the Lord's work by allowing the presidents these prerogatives to go out and do things more quickly than if you had to go through Congress. You send it through Congress at times so the congressman gets some credit, you know, so that he can go back home and say that he had something to do with this. One of the transferring of power is ongoing. This is rather small compared to the war powers, but it's this whole issue of earmarks. We have a bunch of people, conservatives, that this is their whole issue, is we have to outlaw earmarks. Well, that's what we're supposed to be doing. We steal the money, and now we're passing it out. We ought to have the right to tell people where it's going to go. But no, there's not to be any earmarks. The money, if you vote against an earmark, it means that the money goes to the executive branch, and the executive branch just decides it doesn't cut any money. But people just live and die on this to punish the people who won't vote, who will vote for earmarks. But to me, the way I handle that is I vote for the principle that Congress should earmark and take the responsibility of where this money go, whether it's foreign or domestic. But then when the bill is finally passed or it finally comes up for vote, vote against the bill because they shouldn't be dealing with any of that money whatsoever, and they've overstepped their bounds. But that will surely not stop the expansion of the power of the presidency. But this presidency and this executive branch of government these past 8 years, I consider it is absolute disaster. I mean, when it comes to signing statements, I mean this is just flaunting. I mean, flaunting it right in our face and say, you know, I'm going to look at this and one half of this I don't like and I have no intention of following it. I mean, why do they even do that other than to establish the fact that they are king? I mean, they could just ignore it anyway. They do that all the time, or they interpret it any way they want, but they sign these statements, they say, we're not even going to pay any attention to this. And then they come up with executive orders. You know, some executive orders, in my opinion, are proper. Proper to execute the proper role of government. I mean, if Congress declares war and you're in a war, the president would certainly have the authority to have an executive order. But it would be very, very limited. Not to do the kind of things that they've done. I mean, Roosevelt, on an executive order, decided to call in the gold and steal the gold from the people. And it was rubber stamped by the Congress, but there's some very outrageous things by executive orders. So a truly constitutional president would be very, very rarely using an executive order. And other than maybe a clarification, a signing statement, say this is a little bit confusing and I don't know what you mean by this. But you know, these things we do hear a little bit of talk about, the executive orders and the signing statements, and conservatives and libertarians have made comments about this. But nobody really talks seriously about the whole principle of the executive branch of government when it comes to the agencies, when it comes to the administrative courts. From my viewpoint, they're all unconstitutional. The laws of the land should be written by the Congress, not by the executive branch. And then Congress writes a law. It goes into the executive branch. There might be a little bit of squabble. Then there's a court ruling. And all of a sudden, you have these wetland-type bills. I know that's an example of where it got to the courts. And it's magnified tenfold over what the original intent of the Congress was. The Congress shouldn't have done it in the first place, but then they do it and they say there's a little bit of regulation. Then it gets into the executive branch and rubber stamped by the courts, and it's the law of the land. So there seems to be no slowing up whatsoever. And looks like the people are asleep. The Congress is enjoying their way until maybe someday we'll have a financial crisis come. And then they'll say, well, maybe we've gone in the wrong direction. Maybe we're spending too much. Oh, yeah, that's true. About a year ago, it was noticed that we were having some financial problems. And this financial problem, yeah, it came from government was too big. Government was spending too much. Government was borrowing too much. Government was printing too much. Oh, so what should we do? Well, we should spend more, borrow more, print more money, and give the government more power. So it's endless. But, in spite of the pessimism that tends to exist for those of us who believe in true liberty and are associated with the government, actually, I've come away after this past year and a half or so as being a lot more optimistic because of groups like the Independent Institute. They've been around, they're quiet, but they get information out and they're teaching, and this is what changes things. I think compared, David mentioned I had run for presidency twice, the conditions, there were several variables compared to 1988 and now, 20 years later, but there is a difference with the people. I mean, the people, especially the young people, they know what's going on. They know they're getting ripped off. They know this monetary system is a funny money system, and they know the burden is going to fall on them, and they are ripe for the pickings right now for people who will present the case for true liberty. I think what we need to do is present the truth, and that is why what Ivan's done has just been great. Because it will make the people question. They're questioning the government. They need to question our history. And all this stuff we get from our public school system is just so misled us. So we really have an opportunity now for people who are opening their eyes. One thing that has happened during the campaign was that we did get support and enthusiasm from a lot of young people. And once that race ended, which was in June, we still had a lot of momentum, and we are still doing things to try to keep that momentum going. But a lot of young people, you know, well, what are they going to do? And a lot of, guess where they went? They went and worked for Obama. And they still see, believe me, I see a lot of people, and they see a lot of overlapping. And, you know, Obama's for change. Yeah, I certainly was for a lot of change, too. But it means there's still a lot of confusion out there, and a lot of people who are young people who are with Obama with a little bit more education are going to understand what true liberty is all about. But as far as assessment of what to come with the next administration, it's more of the same. It's a little bit scary because some of the anti-war individuals coming from the Democratic side and the liberal side have been neutralized, and they think that Obama really wants change and he's going to stand up and there will be a change in our foreign policy. Right now, I don't see it. I don't see him arguing the case that he wants to be president because he wants to do less for us, that he wants you to have more control of your life and more control of your dollars, and that we will back off on our intervention on our empire around the world. But what is coming, though, and why the work that we do and the work that the Independent Institute does is so critical right now is because we are in the midst of a major sea change in attitudes in this country. It's been happening, and I think because of the last 20 years, we've made great progress. One of the individuals that influenced me a lot was Leonard Reed. But he held the Ford for a long time essentially by himself. But there's a lot of activity going on now. So there's room for there's room for optimism. But it's very important that we keep this momentum going. If we do, we can have some victories, and we can once again reclaim our Constitution and maybe a few more members of Congress who will understand what taking the oath of office really means. Thank you.